Welcome to Faith Uncut, a podcast where we explore faith in ways that might get you kicked out of most churches. I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira.
And it's 2019.
It's 2019.
We made it. We late, but we here. We came into this year real black.
Happy New Year, y'all.
Yeah. So, apologize for last week. We missed the episode. We were recovering. I had traveled during the holidays. We just had a lot of family stuff going on, and it was not possible to get in. But here we are. Recording again and back on schedule.
And happy to be here.
Yeah. Yes. So we actually do have a schedule that we're going to try to keep. Actually schedule the shows out all the way through. We're trying to get to the end of the year, but we're about 50% there. So
Woot woot.
It should be an interesting 2019.
Yes.
I'm looking forward to
it. We're excited.
So this week we're talking surrogacy, suffering, and salvation.
Ooh, child.
Okay. Seems like a lot. it is a lot. This is based on Dolores Williams' essay that she penned. Dolores Williams is a womanist theologian. Mm-hmm. She wrote this essay called Black Women's Surrogacy Experience and the Christian Notion of Redemption. And basically the essay is talking about how we view what Jesus did on the cross and what that means for black women in America and how that's interpreted. So we're going to get into that. Anything that we need to say before we start?
Not really.
Thank y'all for listening. Appreciate it.
Appreciate you.
Check us out on Patreon if you want.
Yes.
And share this podcast if you want to help.
Yes,
if you can't pay, it's after Christmas. Bills are not here. Government is shut down. Taxes, we don't know what's going to happen. Y'all. But what you can do to support is share this podcast. Tell a friend about this podcast. Say, hey, look, I was listening to these folks. They actually do say some things every now and then. So take a look at that. All right. So this essay is interesting in that it starts off not with the theology. It's talking about
starts with the history.
It starts with the history of black people, specifically black women in America.
Yes. It's my favorite subject.
I'm a yield.
So this essay entitled Black Women's Surrogacy Experience and the Christian Notion of Redemption, where she opens up is regarding two faces of surrogacy, basically coerced surrogacy and voluntary surrogacy. And the coerced surrogacy is making someone stand in your role or in your stead under duress. So when you think about the institution of slavery and the different things that, of course, enslaved people were called to do, there was a certain subset of behaviors and actions and tasks that were meant to be done in the place of other people who should be doing them. So in general, I think it's easy to understand, like, oh, okay, you know, you had slaves working in your agricultural business. You had slaves working in your fields, for lack of a better term. And because you did not pay them, they acted as surrogates to paid labor. They were indeed carrying out a job, carrying out tasks and behavior, but not the same as you would have treated somebody else coming to do that work. So you would have never expected a free white person to come and do this work for free or without any promise of some sort of bartering or something. But because you're dealing with an enslaved person, it was just understood that the work would be done and it would not be compensated. But as we know, all the work wasn't just in a field type of capacity. And this is where some of the dynamic about black women begins to emerge, because we've already touched on, you know, in previous shows and just previous conversation, but black women were called to fulfill roles that were on both sides of what we thought, let's say, a gender understanding of a role would be. So you would have black women carrying out more tasks that you would think were for men, working in building infrastructure or plowing or
plowing, raising barns,
or, you know,
houses,
like dealing with livestock or something like that. And then you had a set that worked in different capacity. Maybe they worked in the home and they cooked or they sewed or they reared children. That affected how those women not only saw themselves, but also how other people perceived them across their life. So you could start out in one place and end up in another place. And believe it or not, it would affect whether or not people actually accorded to you the idea of you being anything toward a real woman. I give you the quote fingers. So In talking about the surrogacy, one of the places where surrogacy actively happened, according to this essay and just historical understanding, is within the tasks that were within the home. And one of those tasks or one of those roles had to do with interacting as much as possible, as closely as possible, to your white counterpart. So you became their nurturer. You became their caretaker. You became the trusted person to almost like a governess, like running their household. But nobody called you a governess. You were a mammy. Mm-hmm. And in that role, I think that we realized that Black women took on a lot of different characteristics, but they did not have full access to the expression of those same characteristics. So you take on the characteristics of being a nurturer, but you don't have full access to your own family to nurture them as well. You take on the characteristics of rearing children, but you don't always have full access to your own children to rear them the way that you're rearing white children. And that became pervasive. It became almost like a modus operandi. Like, that's how it is. If you're in the house, I can almost tell you how you are expected to behave. This idea of a more refined Black female presence. I don't know if we would call it feminine. I don't know if it would go as deep as to say that she was overtly feminine and afforded the same safety and the same protection as people who were viewed as white and feminine. I don't think that was ever the stretch and the goal. Really, she was meant to stand in the place of things that maybe white women didn't want to do. Mm-hmm. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah. And that was also the case. So Williams identifies three roles or three modes of surrogacy. One is, as you mentioned, the labor piece. Yeah. So it wasn't just the men out working the fields. It was women doing the same level of heavy lifting back-breaking and labor work as the men. And so if you figure men, that was basically their plight. They had to take care of the work, but then women also took care of the work, so they're equal there. Mm-hmm. And then women go above and have to perform in this mammy role, in this housekeeping role, and it's not just the housekeeper, it's just not the person who comes and scoops out a slice of cornbread for you. This person ran the house. Yep. They had the keys to certain rooms. People had to come to them for things, and they had some measure of authority within that home.
Exactly.
And then the other mode was the sexual surrogacy. Yes. So okay, so Black women were having sex with the Black men on the plantations, mm-hmm. and also the white men on the plantations. But it was even more complicated in that during this time, there was a puritanical idea where the white couple viewed their sex for the purposes of procreation.
Exactly.
So every other sexual desire was transposed onto the Black woman.
Yes.
And so the Black woman was, one, fulfilling the sexual desires of those partners, but then two, from a breeding perspective, it's cheaper to produce your own slaves than it is to buy slaves.
Yeah.
So yeah, you could buy them, but then it's better if you're growing them. That's a terrible way. But if you have slaves,
that's how I felt when I saw The Matrix.
Yeah, that's what it's like. I mean, because I can have slaves for my own that I don't have to pay for, or I could sell those slaves to another plantation. And so it becomes a source of revenue. So this is the third burden that Black women are mm-hmm. assuming during this period. Mm-hmm.
So, and very quickly, because even though the essay, I'm excited about the essay because it even covered that, you know, those pieces. It's not necessarily the point, but you have to understand it's a perfect storm that creates that last line of surrogacy. So it goes from a fetishization of Black female body to the economic purpose of procreating and having children with her, because again, we stopped the international slave trade pretty early. 1808, it was outlawed, and after that, this is a trade that begets itself. So as many children as you have is as many slaves as you produce.
Yep.
For a plantation, for an owner, and because they have a monetary value, now you have people planning, just like they planned what crops were going to go in. And you know, we have to say this because I think it demystifies how Black and white this was from a planning standpoint when it comes to making money.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, there were whole plantations dedicated to producing slaves.
Yeah,
not,
you know,
cotton, not
and
tobacco.
There are places that are known for that. You know, our particular state, we don't talk about it, but they are known for that, that this was a place where you actually had plantations for breeding. people. That aside, that last line of surrogacy is where some of that transaction was lost, in that you are feminine enough for these sexual desires, but I do not see you feminine in these other surrogate roles. I don't see your womanhood. I don't value it. I don't prioritize it. I don't protect it. But I definitely have access to you as all of those things when it comes to sexual desires.
Okay, so after slavery ends, we start to see a reduction of...
an attempt to take our power back.
Of these surrogacy roles. Now, mm-hmm. one of the first... ones off the table was the physical labor, because slavery is over. Yes. Now we're moving into a different space. Women are still doing physical labor, but it's not coerced, that coerced surrogacy. Right. Maybe not overtly, but still
the way society... it's not coerced within the system that we were accustomed.
Right. Sexual surrogacy, we are going to deal with that another time. Okay, so...
come on with it.
The way black women were viewed during slavery mm-hmm. in these roles mm-hmm. Was not that long ago. And so what we're seeing is a problem transitioning from that view of and everything that comes with it, mm-hmm. the hypersexualization, all mm-hmm. of that, mm-hmm. from viewing women, particularly black women, that way. Mm-hmm. The commodification of those black bodies is still something that is ongoing today through our criminal justice system and prison industrial complex, but also through some of the sexualization that we see. And so we're mm-hmm. seeing pushback against all of that. And so mm-hmm. that, we believe, requires a separate show, because we are aware that the R. Kelly thing just recently happened, and we don't want to gloss over something.
No, we're gonna go deep on this.
Okay, so we did mention something about this in our Church 2 episode mm-hmm. from last season, and then also why the church does not apologize for harm. We talked mm-hmm. about it then, and then we also talked about it in Church Hurt a little bit.
Yeah.
But we want to dedicate some serious time to this, and so that's why we're not touching it in detail today. The third surrogacy role, the maternal role, that mammy mm-hmm. role, is the one that we still see as an issue. That was the one that we saw not just white people, but black men especially, trying to further that role. Like, so if you think about like the movie The Help, mm-hmm. You see black women as domestics in that movie, and particularly the white families.
Mm-hmm.
But if you think about the movie The Color Purple, Celie was also a domestic to Albert.
Yeah.
So this is something that persisted, and then we see this theme carry through all the way until very recently, with like some of John Gray's comments about his wife and her role. He's
become very annoying to Amira, but it's fine. Go ahead.
So a lot of the vocalizing of this being an issue
mm-hmm.
is because this is something that it has persisted since mm-hmm. slavery, where particularly black men are willing to allow black women to exist in a space where they are performing this maternal role,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we're fine with it because it helps. It helps us. It helps. Yeah. You know, it's convenient for us, and not really understanding that it's not convenient for them. It's,
at all.
It's the opposite, and we should grow up and be better about our shit.
It's so not that, my son.
Right. Okay. So we're hearing that now, mm-hmm. which is important. It's important mm-hmm. to hear, but I just wanted to put some context to why we're starting to see more of that now, because it's overdue, and it is something that has historical context, and we need to address it.
And we need to explore it. We need to address it.
Okay, so mm-hmm. we talked about mm-hmm. what this means for the cross and theology. Okay. James Cone, the father of black liberation theology, mm-hmm. constructed a view that it basically had God serving as the role of the liberator of the oppressed.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And through Cone's religious upbringing, this always was a theme that was woven through his discourse, saying this happened on the cross. This is the result of the cross, this liberating work. Dolores Williams was one of his critics. P. peer and a critic. Mm-hmm. And she raised an objection that even Cone, in his book, God of the Oppressed, I believe, acknowledged that this is a unanswerable critique by me. And the critique was basically, why are we putting the liberation on a cross? And so she touches that in this essay.
Okay. Right.
So she set the essay up by looking at black women as these in these surrogacy roles, in these surrogate roles.
Right.
Now, Jesus is positioned as a divine surrogate. So whether voluntary or coerced, Jesus is on the cross serving in place of something else or someone else.
Right.
And so the work of liberation is only achieved through that death, that suffering and death on the cross. So Williams asked the question, can there be salvific power in Christian images of oppression meant to teach something about redemption? All right. What she means by that is this is not a pleasant experience for Jesus. This is the right. culmination of all of the suffering.
It
and
hurts.
Depending on how you look at it, it's more or even more suffering. Mm-hmm. Okay. So we talked in another episode, I don't remember the name, but we talked about atonement theories. And I think it was, did Jesus have to die for our sins?
Yeah.
Okay. And we talked through some of the reasons why people say that the cross matters. And so Williams, in her essay, goes through some of the history about how we arrived at those. And she talks through how Origen would, his focus on demons led them to develop a theory around ransom, meaning Jesus is paying the ransom for the sins.
Right.
And so this is like something that is owed for our sins. Now, that theory started to wane as Anselm came through a chivalrous period. And so chivalry became a thing. And
that Jesus is a gentleman?
Well, no, that we would somehow be dishonoring God with okay. our actions, with our sin. And so humanity didn't have a way to pay for that debt. And so Jesus's death serves as satisfaction of a debt owed for dishonoring God through our sins.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So she's talking through how these theories are arrived at. Now, most of the theories terminate on the cross, meaning Jesus dies and then something happens that liberates.
Mm-hmm.
Williams is saying, if you keep doing that, if you keep saying that, it almost encourages people to suffer for divine liberation.
Yeah.
It says, yeah, I know you're suffering, but there's some good on the other side of this.
Right.
And it encourages people to stay in bad situations who have been in bad situations, specifically black women. It tells a story that your suffering is going to be worth it. So keep right. suffering and it suffer all kinda, the way until death.
It glorifies your what oppressive posture you might find yourself in.
Right. Like, because
it's uncomfortable, but it's the best thing.
Right. Yeah. And so she goes on to make another argument, actually in another work, that for the father to put the son through this amounts to divine child abuse. Mm-hmm. And so then we have to go down that path of asking these questions. Why would this be required? Why is God not able to redeem outside of this?
Right.
And so Williams is saying, okay, this is a problem for a lot of reasons, but particularly for people that look like me, we should not be duped into thinking that the goal of our suffering is liberation.
Right.
The suffering is bad and we want it to stop.
Exactly.
So let's pull the suffering out. Let's pull the liberation out from the cross yes. now. And so if you
let's
do that.
Liberate in life. Right. We've talked about that too.
So if you do that, then where do you place it? Where do you place the liberation?
Hmm.
And the answer is in the life of Jesus and the liberating work that he did through his ministry. As Jesus has gone through life, he's spoken to and come alongside marginalized groups. So you have women who now Jesus is elevating through his ministry. You have mm-hmm. people who are sick that are being elevated. Right. You have poor people, all stations, people who are outsiders.
Marginalized.
Right. They're being elevated through his words and his life and his ministry.
Included first.
How do you mean?
Because I don't know that you can elevate without first including.
Oh, you mean he's included? Yeah. Yes. So Jesus' ministry was radical in that he went to the forgotten mm-hmm. and took care of them. And so Williams is saying that's the work.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens on the cross then is not the liberating work. It is the response of people to his liberating work. Right. Mm-hmm. So the cross then becomes the work of evil against the good work of liberation.
Of his life.
Yeah. So what does that mean then for how we, so keep in mind, we talked through atonement theories before, and these are things that, that people believe. Some people believe one of the five that we discussed. Some people believe multiple. But this is something that's been argued. So what do you choose to believe now? If you're in the position of being a black woman, what's more palatable? What makes more sense to you? To go down this path of divine justice through death, or to understand that the liberating work is done in life?
Personally, it has been turning from one to the other.
Okay.
So, because I think that, you know, I've always said, you know, I experienced this thing from the audience. It was very much so a leader-led experience in church for me. Mm-hmm. So, a lot of times that liberation moment or that transformative moment has often been described as his death on the cross to win my freedom. You understand what I'm saying? But where I found that I was challenging that is that when I realized that my life was worth more than to, like, I'm starting to see myself and what I do on a day-to-day basis, or, you know, going through a process of having higher value. And then I realized that if I didn't value it as highly as I did for myself, there was hardly ever cheerleaders or, I don't know, like supporters who were doing that, who were saying, no, this is the good work. This is what you're doing. But I do feel like where I began to challenge, like, yo, does he have value for me here while I'm here on earth? Or is everything going to make sense when I die, when I can't do nothing else? So I've asked myself personally that question without all of this theological framing. But adding back the framing, I do think that it's transformative when you believe that your work has value right here, right now, as you're doing it, as opposed to you're setting yourself up for a legacy you won't even be here to see how others consume. That's different.
And there's something to be said for the fact that this is the life we know.
Yep.
So there's a life that we believe that that we may choose to believe that occurs after this. And we can believe what we choose to believe about that. But that's not the life we know. This one is the life that we know.
And this life is fraught with suffering.
Right. But in space terms, we have one in the possible. So how are we going to bet on this one? Like, do you want to bet that it's in this life? You know what I'm saying? Like, what did we do in this life? This is, okay, we know that we may believe that the other one matters, but we know this one matters.
Of course.
So how do we conduct ourselves in the one that we know matters?
I guess as well as we can, but I do think that a lot of the, I don't want to call it conflict, because I believe just as black women are starting to center themselves and value themselves and, you know, get rid of things that don't work and add back things that really do, I think that black men are doing the same thing. I think that people who are in what we call marginalized communities are all doing that. We are testing out this thing where we are the center of our experience and we are comfortable speaking from that particular pedestal about our own lives. I definitely learned silence, whether anybody intended to teach it to me or knew that that's what they were doing. That's inconsequential to the fact that the lesson was learned that my silence had value in that it made me appear to be at least more compliant with someone else filling in the blanks as far as what is my story going to be. Now, I remark to you that of all of the gifts of the Holy Spirit, long suffering is the one that I am good on. And I was speaking from just reflection and just understanding my experiences that I feel like I've suffered enough. And it's not just for me to change my attitude about how I conduct myself. It has also been about explicitly not making myself available for what here is described as the surrogacy, doing somebody else's emotional heavy lifting about whatever their actions or their tasks or their role might be. And in lieu of that, just doing my own and realizing that my own is enough and that I am not in any way, shape, form, or fashion superhuman enough to do the work of living two or more lives. I do not know that people are aware of how many different people. It's not just your peer, your intimate partner. It's not just your children. It's not just your parents in some instances. It's not your coworkers, you know, who may not be as efficient as you or not as creative. It's just none of that. Because of the weight of the world, which I believe that people carry the weight of the world, their worries, their the impact of their decisions. You live long enough to see whether or not you made the right decision at one point in time. And I just think that wherever people think that they can unload some of that weight, they will. And when you realize that there's a whole group, specifically Black women, who have been trained to pick up the weight of others, when you begin to reject that, watch how everybody else reacts around you. Like, what?
Yeah, and the weight is so heavy too. Because if you even think about the maternal surrogacy, especially like during the period after slavery, during the domestic period where Black women were working for white women, raising their children.
Yes.
You're raising, okay, so you're working for a white woman and raising a child that's going to rule over you.
So, but I don't want to minimize this because there, again, we're looking at this from a theological standpoint because we want to talk about this particular comparison, but I'm talking about like true lunacy. Like, you're not just raising their children. You are also standing in as a de facto wife.
Yep.
When they don't fit. This whole idea of, honey, I have a headache, okay, is rooted in something far greater than she's sexually unavailable to me tonight. It's this idea of the privilege of being able to be sexually unavailable to your male counterpart, because there is a whole system that takes care of his sexual needs. This becomes especially pervasive when we talk about the intersection between that and the economics of it all. The economics did not end when slavery ended, okay? For as many Black bodies as there are to employ, okay, or otherwise use, what do they become the basis for? So even now, and this is a conversation that I'm having with my peers and my contemporaries who are students of history, as opposed to when I come here and I talk to you from a theological standpoint, that we understand that the commodity did not change.
Mm-mm.
Right?
It actually grew.
So
you have the commodification of Black bodies, which helps build this nation into an economic power. And then as the nation grows in power, that commodification base has to expand. And so now you still have the commodification of Black bodies through these different mechanisms, prison industrial complex, the education system, etc. Mm-hmm. But then all of these other groups are getting caught up in this, the immigration, the immigrants, mm-hmm. the poor people, all of it, because the engine has to be bigger now because the car is larger.
Yeah.
And so the commodification is still happening, and everyone else is at the party now, and we're like, yo, we trying to get out of here. and they like, no, we need to be bigger. America needs to be more. Mm-mm. And until we get out of this position of commodification, like, I wonder what the country looks like if that were to stop.
A fourth world. Okay. And we talk about first, second, and third world. It would be a fourth world. Like, I am currently toying with this idea of the pure gold that is found within a Black woman's body, obviously, because when you begin to look at the development of America from a legal standpoint, from an economic standpoint, and from a cultural standpoint, all those roots, pretty much, I'm not taking anything from any other group, but I am saying that the strongest roots of what America became ran right through Black wombs, period. We can argue all day. I got time. But even when you think about that, when you turn that over in your mind and you begin to see, you know, the wealth gap or the continuation of a lack of safety in your own communities due to militarized police or errant law enforcement or inequitable application of laws and things of this nature, it becomes, this is what I'm talking about, carrying other people's emotional weight. That's a lot. And women don't even have full access to how they feel about coming into understanding that those are the rocks in your backpack. You know what I mean? Everybody got on a backpack, but yours has boulders in it, because your boulders actually represent whole systems that are contingent upon you just carrying this. When we begin to reject doing any extra beyond what it would take for, now I'm not saying becoming selfish, I'm saying like this idea, because I don't read a lot of foolishness, but like this idea that your wife could be the extra womb for you to finish growing up, because that's what you needed to become a man, because your mama's womb wasn't enough, is bullshit. Because what you're saying is you are infantilized, right? So we saw the same thing happen. Remember when Al Roker got so upset at the Brazil Olympics, at the Rio Olympics, because the swimmer dude had lied to the police and said that, you know, he was held up or whatever. And all of these journalists, newscasters, oh, he's just a kid.
He's just young,
he's just this, he's just that. He was 32. And it's like you juxtapose that next to Tamir Rice, who's really a child, or Mike Brown, who is just emerging out of adolescence, or Trayvon, who's 17. These are real children who, when you let somebody else describe them, oh my God, there's a big man, and I didn't know, you know. But a 32-year-old man who has access, one, to international travel, international notoriety, millions of dollars in endorsement, is a fucking kid. That is an offense that maybe nobody else really would have felt, except for us losing our children to a false construct of manhood. Not when it benefits me as their mother, right? Or me as their sister, but when it benefits the state or these other entities to treat him as a man, because if I treat you as a man, I can be even more harsh to you. We're not making our children adults to treat them better.
Yeah.
You understand what I'm saying?
Right, right.
So when you begin to reject that and put that down, we've talked about, you know, not doing the heavy lifting, understanding that, you know, in our most errant houses of worship, there are these constructs that are built up on, you know, Black women's participation, but not her critique. She's there. And she's valued so long as she looks like she's in a particular role. Again, mammying. She's nurturing all the other little young Christians around her. And she's, you know, dying over purity culture. And she's sorting through whatever type of pick-me bullshit might have been left for her. When she begins to say, I'm over it, I'm not doing that, you know, Jesus loves me as I am without doing your life work.
Mm-hmm.
The blowback from her standing in her independence, I've been that woman, and I'm very familiar that that's worth it. I'm not strong enough. The women that are described in this essay were stripped of even all of their own identity. Your identity became these surrogate roles, right? So you are no longer, let's make up a name. You are no longer Nancy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You are Mammy. Mammy, which is a universal role, like nurse.
Yeah.
Okay. You are not your name. You are not daughter of. You are not sister of. You are not mother of. You are just the role, right? So a lot of us in experience that when we interact with these institutions or these groups that are not our own. You are not special. You are the administrative assistant. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. You are interchangeable. You are the, you know, HR manager. We can find one of you anywhere. You're not, you know, special. But when you begin to, when I say, get your power back, put your name at the front. I am, you know, Amira is. Those things, they're subtle, but they are so powerful, because you are then saying, my life is enough. My life, what I'm doing right now, you know, what I'm producing of my own hand, that is enough. I ain't got time to not only live for you, but probably cry for you, continue on in the breaking, the great breaking of me for your behalf. I'm not doing all that.
Yeah.
And it's something that's going on. Like we said, we're going to come back to this greater discussion about this sexual impropriety and things that continue to happen. But trust and believe, they continue to happen. And some of the resistance to critiquing it has to do with, I wasn't aware of how many other people are doing this work for me. I wasn't aware of how much of my experience is really based upon somebody not having full control over themselves.
And so that's the the liberating part of it. So part one is understanding, and in Williams' essay, she makes this argument that, hey, we can pull that liberation out from the suffering and death of the cross mm-hmm. into life. But another part of it is women were, we talked about the sexualization through slavery mm-hmm. and continued beyond slavery. I guess a correction may be, someone may choose to correct it by saying, okay, let's not sexualize women. I believe that's an overcorrection yeah. because women are sexual. But the thing is, right. they should be able to choose when they want to express that.
Right.
And so whether it's sexual, whether it's their sexuality, whether it's their maternal sensuality. Thing, like they shouldn't have to raise their kids. Maybe mm-hmm. they want to raise their own kids. You know, whatever it is, maybe they want to be a physicist. Maybe they want to be single. It is in the choice, or women having the choice to choose to do, express whatever element of their humanity that they
that's
want to express.
That's usually where the revolution is taking place.
So I think, speaking, at least speaking to the men here, like it's important that we start to do the work to understand that the liberation, part of that is us knowing that, A, you know, this is what that person chooses to express right now. Cool. Mm-hmm. They don't want to express that anymore. Cool. They mm-hmm. want to open up and let us into their space and have a conversation. Fine. They don't want to have a conversation. Fine. Like, it's not on us. Yeah. It's not us. It's their choice. And you got to be able to know that that's part of the effort going forward. So, I mean, I think that did we talk about any Bible? I don't think so. Jesus says in Luke chapter 4, he's quoting Isaiah, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to go to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovery to the sight of the blind, to set the oppressed free." That's what Jesus is saying, and that's what Dolores Williams is saying. Yeah, that's point right there. Right. That's what he said he came to
that's
do.
That's his revolution.
And none of that, he didn't say, "I came to suffer and die and get flayed and get up on the cross." He said, "This is what I came to do to these mm-hmm. people who are alive while I'm alive." Mm-hmm. All right, so we talked a lot about the essay. Let me give you some of her words to close this out. All right. "The cross thus becomes an image of defilement." Okay, this is her talking about if we put the suffering on the cross.
Okay.
"The cross thus becomes an image of defilement, a gross manifestation of collective human sin. Jesus then does not conquer sin through death on the cross. Rather, Jesus conquers the sin of temptation in the wilderness by resistance, by resisting the temptation to value the material over the spiritual, by resisting death, by resisting the greedy urge of monopolistic ownership. Jesus therefore conquered sin in life, not in death." Now she's referencing the stylized telling of what happened to Jesus mm-hmm, in the wilderness mm-hmm. where he's offered the bread and he's like, "No, I'm not turning it down. That temptation, I'm not doing that. The offer of suicide, mm-hmm. like, no, I'm not doing that. This is the offer of monopolistic ownership. All of this can be yours. Nah, I don't need that. I'm good. We already got that taken care of." Jesus' role was to use his life to provide life, not his death to provide mm-hmm. life. Mm-hmm. And so that is the argument that she's making. That is the argument that we're asking that you consider and talk back to us in the group. Let us know what you think. I think we're done.
Okay.
For Faith Uncut, I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira.
For more on Faith Uncut, check us out at faithuncut.com.